The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Books Podcast with me, Claire Armitstead. Today we're talking science and culture and how to bridge the divide between the two with scientists Richard Dawkins and Carlo Rovelli. Rovelli became an unexpected publishing success in 2014 with his book Seven Brief Lessons on Physics, a short introduction to the science of the very big and the very small that went on to sell over a million copies in 41 languages. His latest, Reality is Not What It Seems, grounds the cutting edge of contemporary physics in an intellectual tradition stretching back to the ancient Greeks. But first, we hear from someone who has been spreading the word of evolution since 1976. It's easy to forget that as well as being the high priest of atheism, Richard Dawkins is a pioneering scientist. His books have sold more than 8 million copies around the world, and he's the only evolutionary biologist to have 1.3 million followers on Twitter. When Dawkins came to the studio to talk to Richard Lee, he began by reading a passage from his latest collection of essays, lectures and articles, Science in the Soul.
The illusion of design is at its strongest in the body shapes and behaviour patterns, the tissues and organs, the cells and molecules of individual creatures. The individuals of every species, without exception, show it powerfully. But there is another illusion of design, which we notice at a higher level, the level of ecology. Design seems to reappear in the disposition of species themselves, in their arrangement into communities and ecosystems, in the dovetailing of species with species in the habitats which they share. There is a pattern in the intricate jigsaw of rainforest, say, or coral reef, which leads rhetoricians to preach disaster if but one component should be untimely ripped from the whole. In extreme cases, such rhetoric takes on mystical tones. The planet is the womb of an earth goddess, all life her body, the species her parts. Yet, without giving in to such hyperbole, there is a strong illusion of design at the community level, less compelling than within the individual organism, but worth attention. The animals and plants that live together in an area seem to fit one another with something like the glove-like intimacy which the parts of an animal display as they mesh with other parts of the same organism. A cheetah has the teeth of a carnivore, the claws of a carnivore, the eyes, ears, nose and brain of a carnivore, leg muscles that are suitable for chasing meat, and guts that are primed to digest it. Its parts are choreographed in a dance of carnivorous unity. Every sinew and cell of the big cat has meat-eater inscribed through its very texture, and we can be sure that this extends deep into the details of biochemistry. The corresponding parts of an antelope are equally unified with each other, but in pursuit of a different route to survival. Guts designed to digest plant roughage would be ill-served by claws and instincts designed to catch prey, and vice versa. A hybrid between a cheetah and an antelope would fall flat on its evolutionary face. Genetic tricks of the trade cannot be cut from one and pasted into the other. Their compatibility is with other tricks of the same trade.
Science in the Soul collects pieces written for websites, newspapers and magazines alongside with speeches given at various public events. Do scientists have a duty to speak up in the public arena?
I think they do. I think that, after all, it's the public who pay the bills. And so I think just from purely self-interest, scientists have that duty. But much more than that, of course, science is wonderful. And so, of course, we should want to tell the world about it. I think Carl Sagan said, when you're in love, you want to tell the world about it. And he was in love with science.
Is that duty all the more strong in an era of climate change and Donald Trump and...
Of course. I mean, Donald Trump and climate change are a major disaster for the world. And so, of course, science is really under threat, and science should be the leader of the charge against that.
Yeah, what are the qualities that scientists bring to public discourse that it's lacking from other places?
Well, both knowledge of the facts and also the scientific method of thinking, the scientific method of evaluating evidence in a dispassionate way and arguing logically from it.
And that's kind of required in a kind of political culture which is full of gut instinct.
That's right. There's too much gut instinct in politics, too much arguing from feeling and not enough arguing from evidence and logic.
Now, do you think scientists might be partly to blame for the recent rise of mistrusted experts?
I'm very sad about the mistrust of experts. We saw this in the Brexit debate, where I think it was Michael Gove sort of said, don't trust experts, you are the expert here. I mean, what utter nonsense. It's been said often enough, when you're boarding a plane, you want your pilot to be an expert pilot.
I mean is the very duty to speak out and the confidence in kind of the ability to see through to the facts and to organise them sensibly, do you think those have led scientists to be overconfident in their pronouncements, which has led to a kind of pushback?
They shouldn't, because scientists really ought to be very frank about what they don't know. Scientists actually rejoice in what they don't know because it gives them plenty to do. But there is quite a lot that they do know. And above all, they have a method for finding out, which is what everybody should adopt.
And telling the difference between the two different regimes.
Yes. Yeah,
absolutely. I'm wondering, one of the things that you speak up about in this Science in the Soul, in this collection, and you don't pull your punches either, is religion, describing it as an infection or comparing it to an addictive drug. Do you think this kind of pugnacious language can risk inflaming the debate?
Yes.
Setting more light than heat? The other way around, rather more heat than light.
There's comparatively little of that in this book, actually, compared to my previous books.
That's true.
There is a certain amount of it. I do think it's important to be honest and frank and clear, and sometimes clarity sounds pugnacious, even if it isn't. I think that there are people for whom clarity is threatening.
And clarity is what you're aiming for here, rather than any kind of attack?
Totally, yes.
Yeah. There's certainly an appetite for your kind of robust engagement. Looking at Nielsen's figures, you've sold more copies of The God Delusion in the UK over the last 16 years than the rest of your books put together.
Is that so? Well, I didn't know that. Can I tell you something else, which is that there's an Arabic translation of The God Delusion, which is not available. It's not official. I get no royalties from it.
It's a pirate copy.
It's a pirate copy, but it has been downloaded 10 million times.
Blimey. Why do you think that people are so interested to hear your particular perspective on this debate?
I'm not the person to answer that. I hope that I'm clear. I hope that I'm pleasant to read. I don't know.
But do you think it's exactly that rational method which you were describing that scientists use in terms of trying to find out about, is exactly having that method applied to these rather more vague questions?
Yes,
and appeals?
I think so. And I think that there are some academic disciplines who believe in languaging up for the sake of more or less showing off. And I think science is complicated enough without making it more so. The great thing is to try to explain it absolutely clearly, and that's what I try to do.
Do you say that science is a vital part of, or it's a scientific way of thinking, is certainly a vital part to political or debates in society? But do you think science has got all the answers?
Well, not all the answers about, for example, moral questions, but even there, moral philosophy, secular moral philosophy, is sort of using the scientific way of arguing, the sort of scientific way of thinking.
That's part of the same domain in some sense.
Yes, because, I mean, you can't actually use science to say fundamentally what's right and wrong, but you can use it to dissect inconsistencies in people's arguments. So if you're taking a point, taking a position on, say, abortion, then a scientist can say, well, your position on abortion is inconsistent with your position on something else.
But I mean, in terms of the big questions, where we come from, what are we all doing here, how should we live?
Oh, well, the first two of those, where do we come from and what's it all about? Science has everything to say about that, insofar as anything does. I mean, there may be fundamental questions, the origin of the universe, the origin of the laws of physics, something like that, which even science can't answer. But if science can't answer, certainly nothing else can.
The best answers we've got.
As for the best way to live, that's a rather different question.
It's an is-ought distinction.
Yes, and I mean, I think science has a bit more to say about that than many people think, but ultimately, you've got to take a judgment on that.
One of the big questions which scientists are tackling right now is the problem of consciousness, where an idea you came up with in 1976 is enjoying something of a comeback. Do you think that your concept of memes is proving slightly more popular now among people thinking about the way that we think, because we have direct experience of them ourselves on the internet?
When I suggested the meme in 1976, I didn't think of it as a contribution to the debate on consciousness.
Ah.
You're right that Daniel Dennett, in many of his books now, and he's probably gone further into this riddle than any other philosopher I can think of.
He was defending it on this very podcast recently.
Was he? Indeed, yeah. Yes. Well, he certainly uses memes in various ways, including understanding consciousness.
Yeah, but that's not where the idea originally came from in your thinking.
No, for me it was just a way of generalising the idea of a replicator, because in The Selfish Gene, It was almost entirely about the gene as the unit of natural selection. I wanted to make the point that any replicator would do, and DNA just happens to be one, but the meme could be another, and on other planets it could be something else.
But do you think that the popular conception of a meme as something that spreads on social media, do you think that's actually helpful in showing people how evolution might work in different ways?
It's a good example, and the internet wasn't available for me as an example when I suggested the meme, but it is a very good example of an ecology of memes.
Another big question coming down the track is that of artificial intelligence. What do you think Darwin has to say, or a Darwinian perspective has to say, about the prospects for humanity?
This is something that worries people that I respect, like Stephen Hawking and Elon Musk. I'm intrigued by the idea of artificial intelligence. I'm committed as a naturalist, as a materialist, to the view that what the human brain can do must in principle be doable by electronic machines. Not in practice yet, but in principle. And so I'm interested and intrigued by the idea of artificial intelligence, but I can see the misgivings that some of my colleagues have with respect to where it might take us.
Oh, I mean, the portents aren't good. I mean, if you look at what happened to other primates when humans did well, then they have been shoved out of the way, basically deprived of environmental niches and dying.
Yes, so you're taking the sort of extreme pessimistic view that we might be simply replaced by our creations.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm taking the view, but I'm suggesting that we
well,
may
it's
have
possible.
Problems.
It's possible, and it would be interesting.
You quote Richard Holloway describing the advent of big-brained humanity as a singularity in evolution, a kind of the beginning of a new phase. Do you think that we're on the cusp of another one?
Very possibly. Richard Holloway is the former Bishop of Edinburgh, a very delightful, clever man. I think he's probably an atheist.
Your kind of bishop.
Yes, my kind of bishop. Yes, I mean, the word singularity is rather overused, but yes, we could be on the cusp of another one with artificial intelligence.
So evolution first at the level of kind of chemicals in DNA,
yes.
And then culturally, as you were explaining in 1976, and now perhaps in a kind of digital realm.
Yes.
Does that prospect excite you or terrify you?
A bit of both. I mean, it certainly excites me, but I can see it would be a bit of a tragedy if we were driven extinct by our own products. On the other hand, they might make a better job of running the world than we do.
So there's advantages and disadvantages, as the classic essay answer. These existential questions about climate change or artificial intelligence or global pandemics, make it all the more important for 21st century citizens to understand science. But do you think that's really possible without understanding complicated mathematics?
Yes. Certainly in biology, mathematics has an increasing role, but I mean, Darwin was a very poor mathematician, and you can still understand the scientific method, you can still apply the scientific method to important questions like the assessment of risk with only minimal mathematics.
There's a certain amount of statistics that even Darwin...
You need statistics, and actually Darwin had help from his mathematical son George on that.
But do you think that prose is man enough for the job?
John Maynard Smith once said a rather nice thing about me. He said that, as far as I can tell, Dawkins thinks in prose, and yet he doesn't seem to be making any mistakes.
And yet.
And yet, because he was, of course, very, very mathematical. I don't think we need to immerse ourselves in the very intricate details of mathematics, just as we don't, for example. I mean, I as a biologist, can't understand modern physics. I can't understand quantum theory. But I appreciate what my physicist colleagues tell me. I know that what they do is subject to the same kind of peer review, the same kind of constraints and policing, really, as my own field. And so there is a kind of fellowship of science where we know enough to trust what other scientists are doing because we know that they are subject to the same constraints and limitations and methods as we are.
You know, how the machine works, as it
yes.
were. You criticise in the book Steve Gould, who you say that he sometimes confused readers with what you call his poetic science. Do you think that's a danger, that scientific writers can sometimes confuse the waters?
He was a superb at rhetoric, and I sometimes think he got carried away by his own rhetoric. For example, in his campaign, really, in favour of discontinuous evolution as opposed to gradual evolution, I think he muddled up at least three different kinds of discontinuity, which are nothing to do with each other. And in any case, none of them would have discomfited Darwin in the way that Gould thought it would.
Mm. So you need to watch out when you're explaining something to a lay audience in prose. You need to watch out for getting carried away.
That's right. I mean, I suppose I have my own purple passages, and you're absolutely right. You have to watch out not to get too carried away.
And you say also that a scientist who pulls out all the rhetorical stops is regarded with at least mild suspicion. Has your own eloquence ever led your colleagues to be slightly suspicious of your ideas?
I think what I said was not quite that. I think I said that a scientist who relentlessly advocates a point of view, like a lawyer, is regarded with suspicion.
It's true.
Suspicion.
It's a comparison with the lawyer, exactly.
Yeah, yes. So, for example, the theory of the aquatic origin of humanity has been advocated originally by Alistair Hardy in a rather tongue-in-cheek way, and then by Elaine Morgan. And Elaine Morgan was an extremely effective advocate, but in a way she was too effective because she bashed away at this particular point, and anything that went against it she would sort of discard. She was so passionately in favour of it. And so that's the sense in which a scientist who becomes too much of an advocate is regarded with at least mild suspicion.
You need to always be dispassionate even about your own thoughts.
Yes, yes.
A difficult act to pull off.
It is difficult, and one of the disciplines of science is to try to put the opposite case if you can, so that you can be more sure of the case that you are trying to make. Don't get too in love with your own theory.
Richard Dawkins talking to Richard Lee. You're listening to the Guardian Books podcast. Carlo Rovelli is Professor of Physics at Aix-Marseille University, where he is the director of the Quantum Gravity Group. His latest book, Reality is Not What It Seems, places the work he and his colleagues are doing in the context of an intellectual journey that began in ancient Greece, taking in Newton, Einstein and Heisenberg along the way. Richard Lee met Rovelli among the bustle of the author's tent at this year's Hay Festival and began by asking him why he begins a book on quantum physics with Democritus in 450 BCE.
Because I think that we understand better if we see things in perspective. A lot of modern ideas in physics are modern, are recent, but there are some crucial ideas that go back in time. And we understand the steps how we got to learn what we know by following the path, the steps through which this was achieved. Plus, is a fantastic story. It's a beautiful story what happened through the centuries in our understanding of the world. So I think it's a story worth telling that was not being told yet.
And you begin with Democritus, who suggested that the world was not infinitely divisible, and you arrive at the same place.
Yes, there is also a direct connection with Democritus, because Democritus is at the origin of the idea of the atomic structure of matter. Of course, Democritus' atoms are not the same as modern atoms, but definitely the trace of the idea of the modern idea of atoms goes back to Democritus, and his central intuition that matter is not continuous, cannot be broken an infinite number of times, at some point we get to the units of matter, was right. And it took very long to prove it, to find it, to convince everybody that that's the best way of looking at the world. In fact, it took 2 millennia, but it worked, and slowly we all got convinced he was right. But this old story is particularly crucial today because I think, and a lot of scientists like me think, that it's not just matter to be made of atoms, it's also space itself, and in a sense space and time themselves. So, honor to Democritus. I mean, he was perhaps more right than what he even thought.
As you move from these ancient insights to modern theories, you also map out a trajectory from results that are reliable to kind of current speculations, a journey which takes us almost to the edge of our knowledge and beyond. Do you think that scientists talk enough about what they don't know?
Yes and no. I think that sometimes scientists make the mistake of not talking about what they don't know. And the mistake is to give an image of science as a solid cathedral of established truth instead of a moving enterprise where we're always scratching our head and not knowing what's going on. But there is also the mistake of the other side. Sometimes scientists have their own ideas which are still speculative, and they're very passionate about them, and they sell them for established. And that's a mistake. And I try not to do this mistake, even if myself I have my own ideas with my colleagues, of course, not just mine, and I'm passionate about them and try to defend them. But I think it's important, and I tried in the book, to make a clear distinction in writing for the large public between what we know reliably. I don't want to say for sure, because scientists should never say for sure. You should say reliably or very reliably, and what we think we see and what we are just speculating. Science is a human enterprise full of mistakes, full of errors, and mistakes in the scientific discoveries. Sometimes people get convinced, scientists get convinced of something, and they turn out to be wrong. The risk then is that if the public loses confidence in science, it also loses confidence in one of the best tools we have for our life. So yes, science is limited, but it remains the best tools we have for understanding what goes on, and it remains spectacularly successful for civilization. And I give a specific example, which is on the first page of the journals. We have no idea how climate change is going to play out in the future, but the best thing we know is what scientists are saying. So not relying, not taking seriously the risks that scientists are screaming about is just being stupid. Even if we don't have a total certainty, and if there are big elements, if somebody screams your house is burning, you don't say, are you completely 100% sure which is burning? Just run there.
Do you think that scientists should speak up more in a world of climate change, where climate change is possible to be denied?
Yes. In fact, I myself have changed my mind about that. I used to think, well, scientists should better do his stuff, and other people in society speak up to the public. I don't think so. Especially when the house is burning, I think it's a responsibility of a scientist, not because he's a scientist, but because he's a citizen, to point out the risks of going into the irrational. I mean, we human beings are irrational, and there's no way to avoid that. But irrationality is the best tool we have, so we should cherish it.
Is this kind of problem come from in our cultural space? Does it come from the divide, the kind of artificial divide between science and the arts?
No, I don't think so, because there's a lot of art, a lot of literature, traditionally and even today, which is enamored of science. There's a lot of philosophy which is enamored of science. It has been so traditionally. I mean, if you read from Kant to Husserl, philosophers want to be like scientists. So it's not art itself, it's not philosophy itself, it's not literature itself. But yes, within philosophy, within human studies, there is a component that has been disparaging against science and has done a lot of damage to humanity. I must say, to try to be a little bit more equanimous, that there are scientists that go around saying science is the only truth, everything else is stupid, which in my opinion are equally stupid, because science has immense limitations, and we get to know, to learn about the world from Dostoevsky equally than, or from Shakespeare equally than from Einstein or Laplace.
You say that there's a kind of an onus on scientists to speak up about issues like climate change, like vaccination, whatever, these kind of public policy issues. What about God?
God is a topic in which some scientists have a strong opinion. I myself am an atheist, I don't believe in God, but I think that the discussion science versus religion in terms of God exists, God doesn't exist, misses the point. I think that religion is something deeply ingrained in what we are as human beings, and it would be better, instead of just going around saying God don't exist, trying to understand what it is, because I think it's something non-negligible and important, which has to do, in my opinion, more with our inner life than the cosmos. So very often it seems to me that the so-called debate, it's a fake debate, because we're talking about two different things. We're using the same words for talking about different things.
You end your book, Reality is Not What It Seems, with the idea that at once the most speculative and the most kind of crazy. The idea that our experience of time can emerge from our own ignorance. How does that work?
One of the most surprising discoveries in modern physics is that time is very different from our intuition. Very different. And in fact, the more we study time, the more we discover that it works differently than what we think. There's not a single time. The past and the future are much more similar to one another than what we thought, and so on and so forth. Clocks go at different speeds, and so on and so forth. At the end of the story, the main equations of quantum gravity in which I work, they have no time variable at all. So this is comprehensible, I believe. But then there is a question, if the best description of the physical world can do without time, what is this sense of flowing time that we know so well? And it limits our life and the length of this conversation and so on and so forth. And I think that it has to do more than the physical world by itself. It has to do with the relation of that particular subsystem of the world, which is ourself, with the rest of the world. So it has to do with this very imprecise and incomplete exchange of information between sort of our brain, or mammal brain, and the world. And the key word here is incomplete information. The sense of flowing, I think, should be traced not just from some basic fundamental equation of physics, but in a combination of understanding the foundation of thermodynamics, the neurology of our brain, and somehow how we as pieces of the world can have this first-person experience. We think about ourselves as stories in time. Our brain is a time machine. So to understand time, we have to understand ourselves, not just the rest. And we have to understand the fact that we represent the world, but in a profoundly incomplete manner. This is not a complete story, it's unclear. I've been working a lot on that. I think is where some of the greatest open mysteries of the world rely today.
The world that you describe in your book is very different from the world that we're familiar with of tables and time passing on our watches and so on. Do you think it's possible to explain how that works without the use of sophisticated mathematics? Do you think it's possible to get an idea of that conveyed through prose?
Yes, I definitely think. I think when we fail to do so is because we don't understand well enough what we think we have understood about the world. Quantum mechanics is so different to explain because we don't have clear ideas about quantum mechanics. One should distinguish the need of mathematics, experiments, etc., for making a discovery, for getting clarity, for proving ideas, for cleaning up our mind, from the simple understanding of something. If you read the book of Copernicus, it's an horrendously difficult and boring sequence of details, of little calculations, geometry, which you need three PhD to be able to follow. One in geometry, one in physics, astronomy, and one in ancient science. But at the end of the day, Copernicus has discovered that we are sitting on a stone, which is not fixed in the middle of the universe, but is rotating on itself and around the sun. So it can be said. And if you say that to a boy, it's just totally incomprehensible. At some point you explain, and the boy or the girl goes to school and learns and find it completely clear at the end of the day. Surprising, because in Sydney people live upside down, right? It's still surprising a little bit. It's still a punch in the nose when we think that we are actually moving at 40 kilometers a second, whatever, right now, you and I. But it's true. And when we look at the sunset and we see the sun going down, we might easily think for a moment and say, oh, actually, the sun is not moving. It's just staying there. And I, on this big rock on which I'm sitting, I'm rotating backward. And that's why I see the sea disappearing. So science can be intuitively realized. It takes time. And I would say more than that. What we think is our common knowledge, understanding of the world, it's actually the result of a lot of scholarly and intellectual work in the past that has created what we consider common sense today. Common sense evolves late a little bit, but following scientific discoveries, I think.
That was Carlo Rovelli talking to Richard Lee. Reality is Not What It Seems is published in the UK by Penguin, while Richard Dawkins' Science in the Soul is published by Bantam. And that's all from us for this week. You can join the discussion on Twitter, at Guardian Books, or on the Guardian website. Just search for Guardian Books Podcast, which is also how you'll find us in your favourite podcast app. Next week, we'll be marking the 200th centenary of Jane Austen's death with a look at her most enduringly popular novel, Pride and Prejudice, with the comedian and author Sarah Pascoe and the historian Lucy Worsley. But for now, from me, Claire Armitstead, and our producer, Simon Barnard, thanks for listening and goodbye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.